What's shaking, my friends? Welcome to the Trembling EMT Podcast. I am your host, the Trembling EMT, and this is my Parkinson's journey. Hey, I wake up in the morning, it's my time to rise and shine. Cause my blessings do some stretching, yes, this day it will be mine. Every word that I speak, every action that I take brings me closer to my purpose, yes, my future I create. It's a long game, but I won't. Super excited about this interview. It's a ketamine trial out of Yale University to find out the effects of ketamine on Parkinson's and depression, and see if it's effective for any other the Parkinson's symptoms. Yeah, let me know what you think. Please send in questions. Hopefully we can get enough questions and do a follow-up. But let me know what you guys think. Here goes. So thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to join me on the podcast. If you guys can introduce yourselves and your title and what you do.
I can go first. So thank you so much for having us on your podcast. So I'm Sophie Holmes, and I'm Assistant Professor of Psychiatry and Neurology at Yale University. And I'm Principal Investigator of a clinical trial, which we're going to talk to you about today.
And hi, I'm Jerry Senecor. I'm a professor of psychiatry here at Yale, the director of the Yale Depression Research Program, and co-director of the Interventional Psychiatry Service at Yale New Haven Hospital.
Awesome. Welcome. So now let's start all. It's a ketamine trial for depression. And for our listeners, what is ketamine? Like, what is the ketamine and what is it usually used for?
So I'll start with that. So ketamine is actually quite an old drug. It's actually been approved by the FDA since the 1970s with the indication of being used as an anesthetic. So for many decades, it's one of the major anesthetics used throughout the world. About 20, 25 years ago, there became increasing interest that because of the specific way, the pharmacology of the way the drug works, that it may have some effects on other neurologic disorders or neuropsychiatric disorders, such as depression, which it really was first applied to, but now some real interest in other neurologic disorders, such as Parkinson's disease.
Nice. And now, in looking up and doing research for this podcast, ketamine is not only used for depression and Parkinson's, it's also used for treating the dyskinesia in Parkinson's, which I thought was very interesting. But your study is focused on depression.
Our study is focused on depression, but because of the way that it works in the brain, we think that it could be helpful for depression, and that's our primary outcome. But we think it could be helpful for the other symptoms of Parkinson's too. Given that Parkinson's disease, the pathology can cause like a loss of synapses, we think that ketamine kind of can regrow those synaptic connections, enabling new pathways to form in the brain, which we think are going to be helpful for depression and kind of ruminative thinking, but potentially other symptoms too. So we're going to measure depression, but also the motor and other non-motor symptoms of Parkinson's, and including dyskinesia. We're going to look at that too as like a secondary outcome.
Okay.
Yeah. I would just be a little, you know, how we use the wording saying that it's being used. It's really being studied. That's what we're trying to understand, if it could be used successfully and safely. So we're still at the point of really trying to determine if this is effective, both for the mood and movement, and movement symptoms.
Okay, right. And that was going to be one of my questions of why the sudden, considering ketamine has been out for so long, and it looks like it's been used in depression for quite some time now. What's the sudden push for Parkinson's and ketamine? But you were saying it's you're starting to look at those avenues as far as what can it also help with, along with the depression that comes with the Parkinson's. Now let's talk about a little bit about that, because a lot of people don't realize that depression is a symptom of Parkinson's, and
right.
a lot of doctors don't address it or give it the light that it's due.
Right. And that's really why we're conducting this research, because I guess most people think of the motor symptoms when they think of Parkinson's yes. disease. But we now know that there are all these non-motor symptoms that can be as, if not more, debilitating than the motor symptoms themselves. So that would include things like depression, you know, cognitive impairment. So depression really is, I think, kind of undertreated at the moment in Parkinson's. So we really want to raise awareness of how much of an issue it is. And yeah, it really does impact quality of life, but yeah. also potentially progression of the disease as well. So that's really why we're conducting this research, because traditional antidepressants, they can be very helpful for some people, but they're not necessarily targeted for depression in Parkinson's. So we really need to evaluate new interventions, and we, because of ketamine's mechanism of action, we have strong reason to believe that we think it will be really helpful in Parkinson's.
Interesting. And yeah, it's definitely under treated, but it's one, because it's under talked about and not giving, because I've mentioned a lot of people, I see a therapist on a regular basis. And when I mention that to other people in my support group or other people with Parkinson's that I talk about, they're like, "You do?" I'm like, "Yeah, it's sort of like depression and Parkinson's is a real thing. It's one of those that it's not terminal, but it's life altering, and it's something that doesn't get better. And to wrap your head around that, you can't do that alone." Like,
exactly.
And it gets, there's a loneliness and depression that some movement disorder specialists are just focused on the movement disorders that don't talk about the non-motor symptoms. And depression is one of them that I don't think, if it was because of the support group that I went to, I would have realized that my depression was because of the Parkinson's and wouldn't have treated it the way I've been treating it now. If someone believes they're suffering from depression and Parkinson's, what should they look for? How do they know that they're depressed, basically?
I'll let Dr. Sanakura take this, as he is a psychiatrist. So,
depression in general is a very, what we call, heterogeneous disorder, meaning it could present in many, many different ways. So there could be many different symptom complexes that can lead to a diagnosis of depression. That's only more complicated with Parkinson's disease, because some of the core, what would have thought of some of the core symptoms of Parkinson's disease could be misinterpreted or confused with some of the symptoms of depression. It doesn't mean that they're not related, but I think a lot of times your neurologist may look and say, "Well, yeah, well, they're not smiling, but that's because of the motor part of it, or they're having problems with sleep, but that's because of some other part," without really thinking about, are these symptoms of depression? Mm-hmm. I think the main thing is, if it's having a qualitative impact on your life, to consider if this is some depressive-like symptoms or depressive like a phenomena that you're experiencing, and it could respond to treatments more specifically geared to that, either some form of talk therapy like you were mentioning, or some pharmacotherapies, or even some other types of somatic treatments that could be beneficial.
So I was reading the other day about the Parkinson's Outcomes Project, which I think is like one of the largest studies to date, and they found that depression and anxiety were like the top things that affected quality of life in Parkinson's, but there was like very low rates of referrals to mental health professionals. I think it was like 2% of the people in this study.
Oh yeah.
So we really need to raise awareness. So like,
it's awesome, yeah, what you're definitely doing,
right?
And I've been and speaking, and I think that same, I don't know if it was that study or there's some study out there that when asked what was more trouble to or what was impacting most in life, it was the non-motor symptoms, the anxiety, right. the cognitive right. fog, the depression.
Exactly.
That so there are some days I'd rather tremor like or flail like a fish, my arm flailing like a fish, as long as I'm mentally capable of handling what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Like if I don't have the mental acuity or capacity to, it doesn't matter whether I can, I'm not tremoring or nothing because I still can't function.
Right.
If I'm tremoring and I can, they're more mentally fit, I can manage things more better. And that's something that doctors or MDSs don't realize.
So I think raising awareness to people with Parkinson's and in the community to say that this is really something that you can talk about. And then I would recommend speaking to the neurologist. And it's that there is, I think generally mental health is underfunded in this country and the world, but we need to like raise awareness and people should ask their neurologists and say, if they are feeling depressed, to then get some the support that they need.
And I think one thing to note is that they might have been dealing with the depression way before the Parkinson's,
mm-hmm.
but so not necessarily now is exacerbated by the Parkinson's, so they might not realize that it's working in tandem, for lack of a better description.
Right. No, I mean, that's the perfect way to describe it. I think it's bi-directional, so it's not necessarily just having Parkinson's disease that leads to depression. We actually think that in some cases it precedes the motor symptoms and it's actually part of the disease process.
Yes, I totally agree, because I know one of my motor symptoms was sleep problems, and that I got diagnosed about 13 years before I got diagnosed mm-hmm. with the motor symptoms.
Yeah.
So it's one of those things, and I always say I was born with it. Everyone's just finding out now that I have Parkinson's, but I was born with Parkinson's. But it's one of those things that, like you said, it precedes it, and it's something that needs to be addressed. Mm-hmm. So tell us more about the study. How did you guys come up with the, like, how did we get from ketamine to Parkinson's treatment?
Okay. So Jerry Sanakura and I are kind of the principal investigators of the trial. So I teamed up with him, as he is one of the world's leading experts on ketamine treatment. It was actually work done here at Yale that's actually led to the FDA approval for depression. But in Parkinson's disease, I'm very interested in it as a topic. My father actually has Parkinson's disease and has some symptoms, mood symptoms as well. And my background was in depression. So given my personal interest in Parkinson's, I kind of put them together. And being here at Yale is the perfect place to study the effects of ketamine on the brain. And again, because of the mechanisms, we think that it could be very helpful for Parkinson's, but no one's looked at it yet. So we need to conduct this trial to see whether it is effective. And then multiple clinical trials will have to be done after this one. But then hopefully we can have a new effective treatment for depression using ketamine.
And now how long has your study been going? Like, when did you guys start the study?
Yeah, so about a year and a half ago. So it's a Michael J. Fox funded trial. And we've had about 8 or 9 people through the trial so far. And we're double blind, right? So we don't know if people are getting the ketamine or the placebo. But generally, we can say that people seem to be mood-wise getting a lot of benefit from the trial.
Okay.
We need 50 in total.
Okay.
Because we need to looking at in a larger sample.
Larger quantitative data, large input. Now, considering it's ketamine, how does the double blind work? I'm assuming there's some type of, so how is it administered, first of all? Let's start with that. Like, is it, because I know I've used ketamine in the field as being an EMT and in the field. How does, like, what's the dosing for the ketamine?
So it's provided in the way that it has been used in the development of the treatment for depression, which is a sub-anesthetic dose. So not the dose you would use to anesthetize somebody, or if you were going to put a breathing tube into something, nothing that you would use at that level. We give a dose over an infusion of 40 minutes. So it's typically a dose where people feel some cognitive and perceptual changes, but almost always stay conscious during the whole experience. And for the most part, stay, you know, in the moment. There's some variability, but most people are fully aware and able to have a full conversation while you're doing it, although clearly with some cognitive and perceptual changes.
Okay.
So not quite the same dose you would use, you know, in the field as an EMT, but a dose that alters cognition perception, but the person is still fully awake and able to communicate for the most part.
Okay, so I'm assuming, because I know Sophie mentioned that it's based on body weight. So yes. I'm assuming it'd be like half the dosage of the normal treatment of, or the normal use.
Well, it would be a little bit, the dose would, you know, vary a little bit, about half to a quarter. But the difference is, as an EMT, you're usually using it as what's called a push, and you're giving it over a minute or two. We give it over 40 minutes, so it's a much slower. So the blood level never gets anyways near what it would get in the form of an IV push.
And then considering the cognitive effects with the how does it work with the placebo, considering there'd be no cognitive effects for the placebo group?
So it is very interesting. There is the potential for some level of what is called functional unblinding.
Okay.
Meaning that people may be able to figure out what they got. But I think, as Dr. Holmes may be aware of after seeing this too, it's actually quite surprising how powerful that effect, that placebo effect, can be, where patients sometimes are wondering, did I get it? Did I not get it? Mm-hmm. And it's pretty amazing. So there is some level of functional unblinding, without a doubt, both to the investigators and to the patient. But it may not be as great as you may think.
Okay. And now, what are their criteria for people to participate in the study?
So we're looking for people, men and women, aged 40 to 80, who have a diagnosis of Parkinson's disease and are experiencing symptoms of depression. And generally, so ketamine can raise heart rate and blood pressure. So we have to make sure that, kind of cardiovascular wise, it's safe. So generally medically healthy, but we kind of assess that on like a case by case basis.
Okay. And now, do they have to have a diagnosis of depression?
No, because again, it's potentially underdiagnosed. So they don't have to have a formal diagnosis.
Okay.
But I would say, you know, are experiencing symptoms of depression, like low mood, less interest in things they usually enjoy doing, you know, concentration difficulties, any symptoms like that people are experiencing. We will assess it, whether you kind of meet our criteria for depression.
Okay. Any exclusion criteria for the study, aside from the fact not having Parkinson's?
Yeah, not having Parkinson's, not kind of being currently depressed, and then just any kind of significant medical disorder that might kind of interfere with our
study. Okay.
So.
Now, you mentioned something that I've always battled with as far as the mood and the not wanting to do things. As far as apathy and depression. Basically, what comes first, the apathy or the depression? Like, the chicken or the egg? Like, can you guys...
Really good question.
talk on that topic?
I think it's a very difficult question to answer, and it probably varies for individual people. as you mentioned yourself, Theo, sometimes, in fact, quite often, some of these depressive symptoms could predate any of the motor symptoms. But in terms of, you know, whether we see the apathy leading to the depression or the depression leading to the apathy, it's really hard to tell. In my mind, it's more of a vicious cycle, and it's hard to like really find that starting point. You know, it's a cycle that's going, and it's really difficult to say which came first.
Yes, I totally agree. And that's just like the tremors, whether the anxiety started the tremor or the tremor started the anxiety. It's one of those exactly. that...
And they can make each other worse.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's something that people, I think, need to realize or just needs to be brought up more, because... And with Parkinson's, it's almost everything you look at is a vicious cycle. It's always a question, what came first?
Yeah.
Right. And I think sometimes we get lost in that cycle, that we don't give it the attention that it's due or don't manage it, because we're like, oh, it's the anxiety. No, it's so. What's your rule of thumb as far as for mental health and self-care? Like, what should you be looking for? What should you give attention, or how do you give attention to something that you don't know where to start with?
I'll start with that, and we can move on from there. I mean, I think, as we talked about this being a vicious cycle, sort of bringing things down, the real goal is to try to reverse that cycle, and whatever step you can intervene at to start to move things in the other direction. A treatment like ketamine or some of these others may produce some rapid improvement in people's mood, people's energy levels, and then enable them to get more involved in things like exercise, social relationships, and you try to reverse that cycle. That's why when we provide these treatments, and I know Dr. Holmes, I've seen every time I see a patient, I don't let them leave without them telling me what they're going to do for fun, mm-hmm. you know, the next few days. What are they going to do for exercise the next few days? Because like most things in medicine, they don't really work in isolation. It really is a combination of behavioral, cognitive, and pharmacological effects that really reverse things and have the best chance of having true benefit. And that's an important thing. So however you can get that vicious negative cycle reversed, that's the approach to take.
Nice. And yeah, that's a good, doing what you enjoy, doing good things, making the best of the energy that you have is always good. And I always tell people, just do one thing that makes you, that brings you joy, one thing that makes you happy, and then use that as your momentum. But you got to start mm-hmm. somewhere, whether it's making your favorite breakfast or watching your favorite show, just don't try to conquer the whole series. Like, right. Don't try to binge watch the whole series and then be mad because you didn't get in binge watching. Focus on one episode. If you watch one episode and you had a good time, then watch the next one and just take it step by step.
Exactly.
And so we talked about the criteria.
Everything.
Yeah. Box just fell over.
I could talk a bit about what's like specifically what's involved and like time frame.
Yes, definitely.
If that would be helpful.
Yeah, yeah. The what does participating in it look like?
And I think people would be interested in hearing about the imaging that goes with this study too.
Yeah.
Oh,
right.
Okay.
So we're also interested in how ketamine works in the brain, and we think it's kind of reforming lost synapses. So we're offering the opportunity to take part in brain imaging before and after the treatment. But that's kind of optional. We're just doing that in a subset of participants, but that will really help us understand the mechanism specifically in Parkinson's disease. So that will involve an MRI scan and then a PET scan, which some people may have had as part of their diagnosis, but we use a radio tracer, which is a molecule that we inject that binds to certain things in the brain. So we use a different one that binds to something on synapses so that we can actually measure synapses in humans that are kind of living. People have previously had to rely on like animal models and looking kind of at autopsy in the brain. But now we can actually do it when people are living, and we can see the relationship with symptoms. So that's imaging that we can do before and after the treatment. And so taking part involves coming to Yale for a screening visit where we assess symptoms of mood, but also things like apathy, anxiety, and Parkinson's symptoms themselves, including dyskinesia. And we do like a medical to check that you're medically healthy. And then if eligible, then people are randomized to receive either 6 infusions of ketamine or placebo. So that will be twice per week for 3 weeks. And then after that, we do all of the assessments we did before, again, to see what the effect of the drug is. So that would be 2 post-treatment like follow-ups. So in total, it's 3 weeks of treatment, but then we have a 1-month follow-up as well. So it's like 2 months overall. And now, so I know I don't know if people are listening from like all over, but it does involve coming to Yale, but we can reimburse for time, but also up to $2,000 now for travel and accommodation if people are willing to travel from afar.
Nice. Now, when you say synapse, I understand what the importance of the synapse, creating more synapse. But can you explain that to someone who doesn't understand what synapse is?
Yeah, I'll try. And then, Jerry, I might ask you, because it's difficult to describe these things sometimes. But so a synapse is like the junction in between 2 neurons. So it's needed for the neurons to communicate with each other.
Yes.
And that's how we kind of do everything. Think everything is based on the communication between the neurons. So we think in depression and in kind of models of chronic stress that there's a loss of these synapses, which can mean that communication between neurons in regions that we think are important for like regulating your mood, we think that could be a substrate for depression. And that's what we think ketamine is targeting. Dr. Senecal, I don't know if you want to...
No, I think you said that very clearly. It really is the way that the brain cells physically communicate with each other. Is, you know, the brain acts as sort of a neurochemical electrophysiologic unit. That's how it communicates. But there are physical connections between the neurons, and they have what's called a level of plasticity that they change. It isn't necessarily hardwired permanently. Those connections can change throughout life to some extent. And that's what we think may be happening here. We may be inducing new connections or more connections in a way that allows the brain to communicate in different, more adaptive ways.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong. In Parkinson's, with the lack of dopamine in the brain, those synapses aren't firing as much, aren't communicating as well, which in turn is what causes the tremors. And with building more synapses, it's almost going to cause some ripple effect as far as the communication in the brain with the, especially if you're taking like Sinemet and or a dopamine antagonist, you're going to create more communication that has previously gone dormant or not functioning correct.
That is very much what we hope. I mean, the neurons that are no longer there will not be able to form synapses because they won't have it. But the neurons that are remaining may be able to increase their level of connectivity in different ways. I mean, we don't know this yet, and that's a big reason why Dr. Holmes is doing that part of the study. But this is some of what we're hoping to understand much better. How much is this change in synaptic plasticity related to the changes that we see, you know, that have been reported and hopefully we'll see in the clinical trial related to mood and hopefully the motor symptoms.
So basically You're trying to see if the current highways that haven't closed down yet can handle the traffic.
Yes.
Very, very good.
I'm
way
I'm going to write that down, if you don't mind.
By all means, go ahead. I've always been, they always tell me that I'm good at analogies.
You are.
Yeah, and that's because, and that's basically it. Then that's the whole thing of neuroplasticity, is retraining the brain to function better with what it currently
with what
has.
You have. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no, then definitely. And that's what I think, that's what I like, or what drew me to the study, to get it out there, because about the whole neuroplasticity and what the possible potential that it could bring if successful, or the avenues that it could open as far as treatment or just awareness to the disease. Because mm-hmm. learning how the brain works is something that people have been studying for centuries, and are going to continue to study it for centuries, just because it's so, I don't even know what's the word, so fluid, or so vast as far as the potential of the brain, that it's interesting.
Yeah, it's a fascinating field that we definitely need to do more research in, so that we can come up with these kind of new, more targeted treatments. So
nice. And now, if someone was looking for information, there's a website that they can go to. Actually, I just had it up and kind of lost it.
If you wouldn't mind posting the like website and links, and I can send you some things. And we have an email address, which is ketaminepd. So ketaminepd@yale.edu. And we have a study phone as well. And we have a really lovely team of people. So our study coordinator, Taylor, who I think you've been speaking to, Eric. You can reach our study team at 475-287-9521.
Repeat that again one more time.
475-287-9521.
9521. So now, how does someone start the conversation with their neurologist as far as the apathy and the depression, and wanting to seek some help or talk to someone? Like, how does someone start that conversation?
I think definitely bring it up at your next appointment. So if you are feeling these kind of symptoms, so any changes in mood or anxiety or apathy, you know, difficulty getting started, those kind of things. The neurologist, it is now, people are more aware of the non-motor symptoms. So I think the discussions now should be more open. And I think, just bringing it up, then hopefully there can be a referral, and they can look at those symptoms and how they can be treated.
Yeah, I think it's very important to not be ashamed or embarrassed of any of these symptoms, and to feel very open and upfront about talking about them, and also not to feel so disheartened that there's nothing that can be done, because there could really be dramatic improvement in those symptoms. It is, right now, there is a real shortage of mental health care providers, and it could take quite a while to actually get an appointment and to be seen. So being proactive is very important, and I realize that's very difficult for many people, especially if you're suffering with apathy and getting rolling is hard. Right. But letting your care providers know, and your family know, how you're feeling, and being as persistent as possible, because some wait lists could be quite a while, but until you get on them, you're not going to get seen. So
that is true.
Take that first step.
And now, this is also something I just keep in mind. They don't have to wait to see their neurologist to ask for the referral. They can talk to their primary.
PCP, yeah, exactly. And in the meantime, I'm going to do a quick plug for exercise, which all the studies are now showing how much it benefits your mood, but also the other symptoms. And I think it really is, I think, the only neuroprotective kind of intervention that we have right now.
Yes.
And so we actually think, and I'm thinking of doing a study looking at the effects of exercise on the brain. So doing brain imaging, we think that exercise can actually have these neuroprotective, you know, forming new synapses. We don't know that for sure in humans yet, but a lot of the kind of animal work suggests that an increase in something called BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor, that's what exercise can increase, and that can help protect neurons from degeneration. So
I think exercise, that's one of my soapboxes, and it's I agree. Posted the data podcast about the one time I had the same effects as missing my medication, right, when I missed a day of physical therapy after being in a routine of weekly. I was going 2 days a week for like a month, and I missed one session. Mm-hmm. And the next day I was having side effects. I literally thought I missed my medication.
Right.
And my wife's like, "You didn't miss medication. You missed therapy." And I was like, "What?" Like, I was floored.
Well,
floored.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it's one of those things, like Jerry, you said, as far as there's a lot of things we can do. Parkinson's is one of those diseases that it's, although progressive and uncurable, we can do tons of things to manage it, from exercise, from group support group, from diet, that we can live more functional lives despite the diagnosis. And that's something that I wish more doctors would explain to people when they get diagnosed.
Exactly. I couldn't agree more strongly with you. It's such a critical part. And that feeling that you have some level of control, which you do, and actually believing that, mm-hmm, is so critical to actually well-being. I know I'm always so impressed at the participants in our study, how active they are with golf, yeah, and boxing, and
yes,
so many other things that, right, they're doing.
And the optimism that they have, despite, you know, having, you know, yeah, a really difficult disease that they're living with, but they have, they don't give up.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And then and that's something that positive outlook on, it's what you put in that you get out. So if a sunny day can be a miserable day, if you think it's a miserable day because it's hot and scorchy and you're sweating, that's the type of day you're going to have. And if you think, oh, it's sunny, I'm going to attempt something, or it's beautiful out, the weather's nice, birds are singing, that's the type of day you have. And that's something that people don't understand because it's never been explained to them. We've never taught ourselves how to take care of ourselves, both physically and mentally. And I think it's one of those things that it's, once again, going back to that vicious cycle, is you put in the mental work, the physical will follow, which will boost the mental, which boosts the physical. And it's something, mm-hmm, that, like you said, just changing the spiralness downward, and just changing the cycle, just one little thing to impact it in a positive way, can go a long way.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more. Yeah. And I think everyone needs to do this and know how to, you know, cope with stress and the difficulties of life and exercise. I definitely need to exercise every day.
Yeah. And that's something that I'm guilty of. Because when I'm in it, I'm good. And then when I stop, I'm equally as bad. So it's one of those things that we need to get into it. I need to get back into it.
Yeah, but be easy on yourself, though.
Let me tell you a little about me and what I do as far as the Grace Strong Foundation. I got diagnosed in 2018 with Parkinson's. I had been in the advocacy field as far as helping families with cancer, with women battling cancer, and bringing them support and stuff like that. And I went looking for resources in my area and didn't find any. And I was like, at first my friends were like, "Oh, you need to do something in the Parkinson's realm." And I'm like, I had enough on my plate with the Cancer Society and doing advocacy there. And I was like, I've barely gotten anywhere with Cancer Society. I'm not going to, like, I know where the avenues are. I know the where the resources are. So I'm not going to get anywhere in the Parkinson's community. They're like, just trust us. You need to start. So I started the podcast. Got it 6 months into it. I was like, no one's really listening. I'm just going to close up shop. It was good. And I got a Instagram message from a grammar school friend, a childhood friend of mine, so we've kept in contact. And she was like, thank you for telling your story. I know what my dad's going through. And I was like, I was floored. I was like, what do you mean? Like, what do you mean your dad has Parkinson's? He's like, yeah, he never talks about it, so I can't talk about what I don't know. And I was just like, I was flabbergasted. So shortly after that message, I started the Grace Strong Foundation to help people move forward. Because one thing was, I was in healthcare, had worked in nursing homes, was working at a trauma center in New Jersey and a children's hospital. And if I had trouble finding resources where I knew where to look, people right. that just diagnosed with something like Parkinson's, we're going to be completely lost. Mm-hmm. And basically, my goal is to create resources where they're needed or just point people into the right direction, whether they're looking for research, saying, hey, there's this here, or they're looking for information on where to live with Parkinson's now. Mm-hmm. Go to the Davis Finney Foundation if they're just looking for the general information. Go to Parkinson's Foundation and just pointing them in the right direction so they don't feel overwhelmed, because the disease is overwhelming on its own. Okay. Now you're trying to find the resources. And not to say that if they go to Michael J. Fox, they won't find general information, but they're not going to find specific.
Yeah.
Or like if they're looking for research and go to the Parkinson's Foundation, they're going to find some research, not as much as if they go to the Michael J. Fox Foundation. To just help people navigating the diagnosis, we actually created what we call a don't panic guide, which literally starts off, if you're reading this, you just probably got diagnosed right. with Parkinson's. I'm not going to lie, it's going to be a shaky road ahead, but here are the steps to get you on the right path. And it literally starts, do you have a neurologist? Yes? Okay. Mm-hmm. If you don't, here's a list of... Here's one or two, mm-hmm. three lists of comprehensive, or not comprehensive, but a significant amount of neuro MDSs in your area. If they say yes, the next question is, have you started exercise? No. Here are the four leading exercises in the country. Rock steady, power, LSVT. And then if they say yes and moves on, do you have a support group? No. Okay. Here's a list of places Amazing. Of support group. And it's just, and it's something that we created over a year of hearing the same stories. Oh, it took me forever. Cause most people, I think I have a Sunday support group that meets weekly and there's about 12 to 15 participants. And out of those 15, one only got a diagnosis within like 6 months of developing symptoms, or most of us have went 1 or 2 years with jumping around trying to get a diagnosis. And even after that, the things that are on that list, they didn't happen overnight because we didn't know what to look for, what to do, what steps to take. So it's just basically saying, hey, do these steps, it'll put you in a better mind frame and a better road to live a more functional life.
Mm-hmm. That sounds amazing. Because just helping people not be completely overwhelmed because there is help, right?
And at least my goal is in Pennsylvania, and as far as my voice can reach, is for someone to get diagnosed and say, hey, you have Parkinson's. For the doctors to use the word manage, let's manage your condition. Because I think using the word treatment gives people a false sense of security or false sense of outcome, because treating means there's an end to the treatment and there's a resolve to that thing that you're treating. There is no resolve when it comes to Parkinson's because it's progressive. So you're managing the progression. So for doctors to use the word manage when they give the diagnosis and then say, hey, here's a great strong foundation. They'll get you set up with resources to on your journey. And just basically, even if it's just someone comes and says, wants to talk or just not even talk about Parkinson's, just I don't even know what's the term. Just have a place to de-stress and decompress from the diagnosis. Mm-hmm. And I tell a story of a lady who came to one of my support groups, and I always say I've met three people that day. I met the daughter who just brought her mom, who just got diagnosed a month before. The mom who had just got diagnosed with Parkinson's, and the mom who left with a new outlook on her diagnosis. Because literally her second question was, am I going to die from this? And I was like, from what? And I was just like, she's like, from Parkinson's. I'm like, no, you'll get to live your life just as you planned. I said, it's basically, you're still going on the same road trip. Your car is just needs to be modified and you need to take extra steps to get to that journey. But you can still get there. It's just, it's a different vehicle now that you're driving to that destination.
I've been very impressed by seeing the increasing number of patients we're seeing now with what appears to be a mismatch at times between the actual functional impairment due to the motor symptoms and the impairment that I'm seeing due to the anxiety and the worry and the withdrawal. Mm-hmm. And you know, they're not always as correlated as you may think they are. And I think so much is that anticipatory anxiety, so much a fear of what is going to happen that really impacts the person's ability to enjoy the present day and the here and now. And trying to get to that, I think, is exactly what your work is doing, is to try to not let people get overwhelmed, keep people focused on the here and now, and to do what you can while you can to make that road much smoother ahead of you.
Yes, and it's true because especially take people that are used to planning and thinking ahead. And I think the uncertainty of the progression blinds people as far as what they can't do and they can't and they could do. Mm-hmm. And it's something that we're trying to just bring light to. So anything, so I always end the podcast, if someone took one thing away from this podcast, what would you like it to be?
Okay, I'll start. That there is hope, and kind of the message that you've just given, which is that it is a very difficult disease. Life is very difficult, but that we do need to talk about mental health more. So raising awareness of it is really important, and that there is hope. We're looking at new ways of kind of treating, you know, the mood symptoms as well. And yeah, I guess from what we've seen from all our participants so far is that despite having these mood symptoms, the outlook generally is so positive and it's like inspirational. A lot of the people that we've come across in the Parkinson's community. So just keep going is my last message.
Nice.
And I would have a very slight modification of that, basically that there is hope and that you can have Parkinson's and have a very good quality of life. Just don't allow some of these mood symptoms to be such a hindrance to you by not paying attention to them, ignoring them, or just not, you know, pursuing ways of improving your mental health during this, you know, struggle can really change the quality of people's lives. And I guess if there's any take-home messages, if your mood is significantly impaired with your Parkinson's, be assertive, look for some type of mental health care. You know, and at the first level, it's probably going to be more behavioral things like an exercise program or anything, but don't wait. Try to get started with some level of mental health care as soon as you can.
Yes, and to add to what you just said, one thing that I realized that talk to your care partner and you might not see it and say, hey, do you think there's an issue? Do you talk about, bring up the mental health conversation, start it with your care partner, because they might see what you're not seeing. And or if you're a care partner and listening to this, start the conversation with the person with Parkinson's and say, hey, there's something there. Let's talk about it. Let's see what we can, how we can help. But
absolutely. And can I also say thank you, Eric, to everything you're doing as well.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome.
People in the community. So, like, it's amazing what you're doing. So, thank you.
Welcome. Hold on one second.